Hello and welcome to the Lancet Digital Health Podcast. I am Rupa Sarkar, the Editor-in-Chief of the journal. We are going to be talking about a new study published in the Lancet Digital Health this month that describes an automatic machine learning tool that shows that clinicians with limited coding and no deep learning expertise can train a deep neural network for medical image diagnosis. And today I'm delighted to be joined by the lead author, Professor Pierce Keane, consultant ophthalmologist at Moorfields Eye Hospital, and according to Moorfields NHS.uk, he was ranked by the Ophthalmologist magazine as the number fourth on the Power List Top 40 Under 40, a worldwide ranking of ophthalmologists. Fantastic. We're delighted to have you here, Pierce. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rupa, for that very kind introduction. In the interest of your listeners, I should say that that list was from 2015, and I'm no longer under 40, so I should be honest about that from the start.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you for that. So maybe you could tell us a bit more about yourself, your career, and how you got into the digital health field.
So as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm from Ireland. So I grew up in Dublin in Ireland, went to medical school in University College Dublin. And just from an early point in my career, I was just always interested in new technologies and digital health. And I was also very interested in being a clinical academic. And so I qualified in 2002 and I started my ophthalmology training in Ireland. And then I decided that I'd go to the US because I felt that this was one of the best places to go to pursue an academic career. And I was very interested in advanced ways to image the eye, such as this thing called OCT, or optical coherence tomography imaging, which is the dominant form of imaging in ophthalmology. And so I went to Los Angeles for a couple of years to work on that and work with some of the world leaders in that space. And so my intention was to stay in Los Angeles or stay in the US and pursue an academic career there. But what happened was I actually heard in the UK about the National Institute for Health Research, the NIHR, and I heard about these clinical lecturer posts that they have and this opportunity to finish my clinical training while having protected time for research. So I actually came to London in 2010 and was an NIHR clinical lecturer. And then in 2015, I became an NIHR clinician scientist. And so this is like a really privileged position for me because it funds me as a consultant ophthalmologist in Moorfields, but also funds me as a researcher at University College London. And 70% of my time is protected for research. And so that's just like a joy to be in that situation. And basically, my clinician science, the kind of selling point, if you like, of the Clinician Scientist Award is that I'm interested in new technologies. And so although I don't have a computer science or an engineering background, I essentially like to identify new technologies from the tech world. You know, anything cool that comes out that I read about on a website or a blog or see on Twitter, and see if that has a healthcare application, and in particular an ophthalmology application. So that could be artificial intelligence, that could be virtual reality, augmented reality, it could be Internet of Things. And so really what happened then was in about 2014, I was becoming interested in AI and particularly in deep learning. And so in 2015, I initiated the collaboration between Moorfields Eye Hospital and DeepMind. And so we began to apply deep learning to these OCT scans.
It's quite interesting that you are a clinician without a background in computer science. So it brings me to my sort of first question about the paper that we're here to talk about. So why do you think it's a good idea for clinicians with no experience of machine learning to be developing machine image diagnostic classifiers as is described in your paper?
Mm. Well, I think before I answer that directly, I would say that my experience over the last 4 years working with DeepMind is to work alongside these world leaders in the field, people like Olaf Ronneberger, Jeffrey Defoe, like these world famous deep learning experts who are like kind of like Jedi masters of deep learning, and in some senses be in awe of their abilities. And so then when you see these automated deep learning tools become available that potentially allow clinicians to at least in some way emulate some of that work, it felt like a very exciting thing to do. The other thing that I would say more directly then is that what I've come to believe is that there is huge potential for deep learning and these latest AI advances in healthcare. And that ultimately, that has to be driven by clinicians, and it has to be very patient-centered. And as clinicians, we need to know enough about how that works. So we need to have like this conceptual model of how, say, convolutional neural network works, so that we know enough about where it will be useful and where it won't work. We need to know that this is not magic. And so what I've really been learning over the past few years is how to identify use cases for deep learning, and then how to work with engineers and computer scientists to evaluate the performance of deep learning models. And then once we've created a model, how do we robustly clinically validate that? And how do we begin to develop clinical trials to implement that? So for me, using these automated deep learning models is just a way to further our knowledge about every step along the pathway of the development and implementation of this technology.
Yeah, I completely agree with the idea of robustly validating these kinds of studies. So can you tell me about the inspiration for your study? What problems did you see that you thought you'd be able to address with your with your research?
Well, I think the inspiration for this study was an article that I read in the New York Times in November 2017 by the journalist Cade Metz, where he talks about building AI that can build AI. And this was the first time that I heard about AutoML, and the first time I heard about some of these other deep learning platforms. And so one of the things that that inspired us then was that we can start to investigate the feasibility of using deep learning in a range of different medical imaging and other healthcare problems. And we don't always have to scale it up into a big project with a team of, you know, senior scientists from DeepMind. We can begin to do like proof of concept testing of these things. Because one of the things that I believe is that there are, even without any fundamental breakthrough in the computer science, there's like 100 or 1,000 different applications for deep learning in healthcare that we can begin to explore, and that'll keep us busy for the next 5 or 10 years. So we have to be able to, you know, lead that exploration.
So can you tell us about some of the results that you found, explaining the kind of tasks that you tested in this study? What situations did AutoML work well, and when didn't it work so well?
Well, so one thing that I would highlight is that a key point of this study is that, and a key point of my learning about AI in healthcare over the last few years, is that you have to take a lot of care when dealing with medical data, and you have to make sure that you have patient and public engagement, you have to make sure that you pay attention to data protection and privacy and information governance. And so what we decided to do as a first step was to take publicly available medical image data sets and use them to test our proof of concept before we actually start to use any sort of data from war fields or data from the NHS. So we take a very cautious approach to the use of patient data. So what we did was we started a process to identify all of the best medical image data sets from around the world. We identified data from chest x-rays, both adult chest x-rays and pediatric chest x-rays. We identified skin lesions. We identified retinal photographs for diabetic eye disease. And lastly, we identified optical coherence tomography, OCT scans. And we, using those publicly available data sets, we started to train the algorithms. And what was, I think, apparent to us from an early stage was that members of my research group with no coding experience were getting pretty darn good results pretty quickly using these using this technology. Now, of course, lots of caveats associated with that, and I have to be careful not to get too carried away with the claims that we make. But we started to show that in binary classification tasks, like saying referable or non-referable diabetic retinopathy, we're getting pretty good results that could be comparable in some way to some of the state-of-the-art results that have been presented. We started to look at some multiple classification tasks and got, I think, pretty okay results in that, and then began to examine external validation in at least one of the data sets that we presented. And I think it's fair to say that our results weren't as good in that regard, and there's still much to be done. And what I would highlight, though, is that These are with these publicly available data sets. And what we found is that actually a lot of the decreases in our performance could be attributed to the fact that these public data sets often have inaccurate labels, they've got duplicate images, or they're not of a large enough size to actually produce really strong results. So we're really excited about having all the necessary approvals to work on larger data sets with much higher quality labels. It'll be really interesting to see where that takes us.
What sort of level of external validation or accuracy do you think you will need to be seeing this kind of tool in the clinic? Or do you not envision this going in the clinic at all? Is this more of a learning tool for clinicians?
So I think that in the short term, this is going to be a learning tool for clinicians. I think, you know, although I'm, you know, super excited about this, I think we have to mix that enthusiasm with caution. I think in general with deep learning, even for like bespoke deep learning, state-of-the-art deep learning by world expert scientists, we have to be cautious in implementing it in patient care because there are a lot of ways that it might not work. And I would say we need to be doubly cautious if we're talking about implementing automated deep learning by people like me without extensive coding experience. And so I would say it's a number of years away before we would ever do anything in real patient care, and there would be a lot of other validation that would be required before we'd ever do that. So I just want to really emphasize that for the listeners.
Wonderful. So tell me about the physicians that tried this technology, and there was 10 hours of study time before they had enough skills to relate with the interface. What did they think of the tool, and do you think that there'll be a lot of uptake from other physicians? Yeah.
So I think that they liked the tool. We certainly have a number of areas where there's room for improvement. But I guess most of them were just so excited that they could start to do this. And they'd been, reading so much around the hype around AI over the last few years, and then they're feeling empowered by being able to do this. And one of the nice things that we've tried to do for this publication in the Lancet Digital Health is create a supplementary video where we actually show one of the team members using the interface, because I think that gives you a more concrete feel for actually how it works in practice above anything else.
That's fantastic. So you use Google Auto ML. Are there other platforms, other cloud-based platforms that you can use? And are you going to be looking into different platforms?
So that's important to emphasize. We have long-standing collaboration with DeepMind and with Google, and we used AutoML because really that was the first one that we could get access to. There are a number of other platforms. There's one called Platform.ai. There's Amazon SageMaker. There's Microsoft Custom Vision. There's Baidu EasyDL. There's quite a few others of these. And I think it's important that we now begin to explore the accuracy and the validity of all those algorithms. And we'll find that we'll find that some have strengths in certain areas, weaknesses in other areas. And it'll be for me or for my research group or other researchers around the world to begin to do this. I would just caution that as well, when I tell other clinicians about this, I think there's a very strong excitement to start to do this with real patient data or like from their own institutions. And I just would highlight that there still should be some rigorous process around using actual real patient data. And I just hope that no clinicians will get carried away with their enthusiasm for these things and, do anything inappropriate.
And by inappropriate, you mean using properly de-identified patient data, getting consent appropriately?
Yeah, so I think that the when we're talking about medical images, we have to make sure we acknowledge that medical images are potentially identifiable. So we need to have processes in place to robustly anonymize the images. We need to have safeguards in place. We need to have other processes in place whereby these things can be audited, the use of patient data. This is not a trivial thing, and a lot of thought does have to be put into doing this correctly.
And where do you envision the future of this research? What are the unanswered questions that you want to go and find out based on this study? So what are the next steps?
Well, the next steps for us in Moorfields are we have been working with our information governance department to get approvals to do this using Moorfields, anonymized Moorfields images. And so we hope to conclude all of those processes soon. And so, you know, as part of that, you have to do this. You have to, in the UK, you have to do data protection impact assessments. You have to do cloud security checklists. You know, you have to have data treatment SOPs. You have to have a very clear description of how you're doing things. Now, once we have that, we think the sky's the limit in terms of, we've already got maybe like 20 different ophthalmic publication or projects that we're interested in. We're also interested in trying to replicate some other kind of seminal deep learning work, particularly in ophthalmology. So there's a study that was published from UK Biobank where people from Google were able to predict biological sex from retinal photographs with a high degree of accuracy. Wouldn't it be amazing if people without coding experience could replicate some of those findings? And then lastly, in the longer term, I think that this could be a tool for patient and public engagement as well, because I think that we have to demystify AI and like to patients and the public. And, you know, deep learning is just another tool that we're going to use in our patient with our patients. And so, you know, you could imagine showing patients this is how we train a deep learning network and creating tutorials for some, at least some patients and members of the public could really help with patient engagement.
Okay, wonderful. So with patient engagement and understanding how deep learning is a tool, do you have any thoughts on how to improve the issue of explainability or the lack thereof in these tools?
So I think that that's an important point, and that's a shortcoming of the current automated deep learning platforms, a shortcoming of AutoML. It doesn't really give you interpretability of the findings. And I think that that's a whole other area, a whole other research topic. I think it's important to differentiate between interpretability from a machine learning perspective and interpretability from a clinical perspective. And I'm really interested in the latter. I want to know, as a doctor, if an algorithm tells me that someone's got something wrong with them, could it be giving me the right answer for the wrong reasons? Mm-hmm. And that's going to be important in those patients, because you could imagine a situation where an algorithm is telling you that you need to give this person an injection in their eye, and you're looking at the image, and you're thinking, it looks pretty good to me, it looks normal. But a doctor then might have begin to second guess themselves because this world record breaking algorithm is telling them they need to do something. And whereas if you have interpretability, you can say, oh, it's made a mistake here. Yep. That's why it's giving me this erroneous output. And I can sensibly override that decision.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for coming in today. It's very exciting. I actually want to go away and try it.
Sure.
Can I do that? Can our readers do that?
That's the exciting thing about this. The readers can replicate our results. These are publicly available data sets. You can see if we've done this right. You can see if we've done this wrong. This is open science. This is what it's all about.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much. And on that note, we will wrap up. Thank you very much for coming in. And for our readers out there, please do read the paper by Piers Keen and colleagues on our website. It's open access. It's open science, so there's no excuse. And it's called Feasibility of Automated Deep Learning Design for Medical Image Classification by Healthcare Professionals with Limited Coding Experience. And also check out the link comment, which contextualized the study. And it's written by Tom Pollard and colleagues at MIT. Thank you very much for listening.